This is series 7 of Events That Made Me, from boardroom to box office, and I am Liz Taylor. My guest today is nothing short of box office. Marisha Wallace is a Broadway star and a West End performer. Marisha is best known for her starring role in Dreamgirls, but most recently as Sally Bowles in Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club. Her life, however, hasn't always been glitz and glam.
I was in this small town that I was like, if you don't leave, you're either going to get pregnant or you're going to be trapped here forever, you know?
So, how do you swap life in a small town for the bright lights of the West End? Can you lose weight and still indulge in M&S millionaire bites? What happens when someone that you know scams you out of £60,000? You're going to hear all about that and more. The first event that Marisha gave me that made her turn left or right was when she came over to the UK as an emergency replacement to play the character of Effie White in Dreamgirls back in 2017. Marisha told me how it came at the most unexpected time.
So I was playing a tap dancing egg on Broadway. No word of a lie. I was in a show called Something Rotten. That was the name of the show. And it was kind of a spoof on like Shakespeare. And I was on Broadway. And actually, Kevin McCullum, who you are going to be bringing up on your podcast really soon, I think, he was the producer of Something Rotten. I got a call while I was actually in a reading for a different musical altogether. I was in a reading, and Stephen Schwartz, the composer of Wicked, was sitting like across from me watching this reading. And I see a message on my phone from my agent. And anytime your agent calls, it's something you got to run. So I went out for the break and I was like, what's going on? And he was like, do you want to play Effie White in the West End? And I was like, what? Because, okay, go back. The egg that I was playing in Something Rotten was called Eggy White. And I would jump out of my egg and I would sing, and I am telling you, I'm not going to be an omelet. No, 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 no. Like, that's what I sang in the show, in the Broadway show. And it was like a big funny thing, blah, blah, blah. So then my agent called and said, do you want to play Effie White, like the real Effie White in Dreamgirls in London? And I was like, okay. And he was like, can you come tonight? And I was like, tonight? I'm still at a Broadway show, mind you. And I was like, I can't come tonight because I have this concert on the weekend, which is so crazy now because I should just went that night because it wasn't that important. But it was good that I did because it gave me like 3 days to pack up all my stuff. I knew then I wasn't going to come back. I don't know why I knew. Well, I did know why I knew because I had been praying to God to get me out of the situation I was personally. I was in a really bad relationship and I was like at the end of my rope with the relationship. And then also my show, Something Rotten, was closing and I didn't have any money. I was like, if I don't get another job, we're going to have to move out of our place in Harlem. Like it was like a, so there was two things happening at the same time. And then when I got that call and I was like, okay, God, that's true. Was this is the answer? What? Move to a different country?
How old were you, Marisha, when this happened?
31.
Okay, 30, so you were no, 31? You were no, I mean, you weren't that young. So it must have been a massive pinch me moment that, because those things sort of don't just happen. But your upbringing was a far cry, wasn't it, from the bright lights of Broadway. You were a North Carolina girl and your childhood revolved around religion and music. Was that when you knew that you were destined for the stage? Were you sort of involved in the church, singing? Tell us a little bit about what happened pre.
So I grew up on a hog farm in North Carolina. So like, the hogging and farming agriculture industry is big where I grew up. Like all my family were farmers. So we're like one step from slavery. Like I think that's always so mind boggling to me. Like my great grandfather was a slave and those same farms that were a plantation became the same farms my family like tilled for years. So like my grandma pulled tobacco for 50 cents a day. My mom was in the tobacco field when she was young. My dad's side, we had a hog farm. So we would like raise up the hogs and then take them to slaughter. And that's how we made money, just in raising chickens and selling eggs. And it's crazy. It's crazy because I don't feel that old, but that place feels very old, if that makes sense. It feels like it's in a different time. But that's how I grew up. But we also grew up singing in church. So my grandparents were the pastors of the church, and my dad was the guitarist, and my mom was the choir director, and my brother was the drummer, and my sister played drums and piano, and I was a singer, and our whole house was full of music. Like our house was so loud. That's all I remember. Cause everyone was practicing their instruments. Everyone was singing all the time. So that's kind of how I grew up. And we grew up very poor, but I didn't know I was poor until I left. And I was like, oh, we weren't well off, because my mom and dad did such a great job of hiding it from us, because they would sacrifice to get us the things that we wanted, or they would sacrifice to try to make it seem like we were doing better than what we actually were. So it's very interesting. But that tenacity, that hard work, that work ethic that my parents instilled in me, I think is why I'm successful today.
But am I right in thinking that there were challenges with your father?
Yeah. So my dad was interesting, because he was obsessed with music. Like, the music meant more to him than anything in his whole world. Like, he built a studio like next to our house where he could just be in that studio every day just making music. And was the music great? No. Was the writing very good? No, but you couldn't tell him that. Like, even to this day, he's like 73 years old. And he's like, my album's going to come out. But it was kind of almost like a mental health thing where the music drove him crazy, which it was very interesting to see. But then I was the first person to ever have that thirst for music and actually made something of myself. And my dad really struggled mental health wise. And it's just been like a theme of mental illness throughout my life. Like, my ex-husband and my dad, and my mom has really bad mental health issues as well. But the music kind of saved me, I think, from that.
I think everybody has something that saves them when they have personal challenges. And I know during lockdown, I wrote my book, Tailor Made, which was very cathartic. And I wanted to sort of, you know, get everything out there. And we all have mental health challenges and issues. And you either sink or you swim. But one challenge I know that you do have was that in 2002, and I'm just trying to work out how old you are. I think you must have been about 17 then. For somebody who was so committed to singing and music and everything else, you almost lost your voice.
Well, see, that was the thing. Like, I was in this small town that I was like, if you don't leave, you're either going to get pregnant or you're going to be trapped here forever, you know? And my voice was the one thing that I knew. My talent was the one way to get me out. And I was auditioning for colleges to go to school for music. And I go to the audition, and everyone has told me at this point, oh, your voice is amazing, blah, blah, blah. And I go to audition for the school, and all the teachers, because I had to sing an aria too, by the way. I'm a gospel singer who had to sing an Italian aria to get into a music school. That's wild in itself.
I must just tell you, I've got to just interrupt you, because I went last Friday night to see Andrea Bocelli at Manchester. Oh, my God. And he was accompanied by two opera singers. And I don't think I was like in a trance.
It's amazing.
Amazing, amazing.
He's incredible.
The whole aria and the whole opera is just, for me, I mean, I play the piano, so I'm so into music. Sorry, I interrupted you. Carry on.
No, but it's like the basis of all singing is opera. It's like being a dancer and you have to study ballet. So that's kind of like the same thing. But anyway, I go to audition, and I thought it was just because I practiced so much that my voice was a bit raspy that day. And the teachers say, something's wrong with your voice. We can't allow you to join the school. And I had already like been accepted to the school, but I hadn't been accepted into the program. So I was leaving, about to cry. And then one of the professors, one of the Black professors came behind me and was like, don't leave. I feel like you have something special about you, but we got to figure out what's going on with your voice. So he was like, come back for a free voice lesson. And my teacher at the time, Miss Grantham, who was incredible. So she was my music teacher in high school. She was taking me back and forth on her own dime on the weekends to go to the school, to go to the lessons, to go to the doctor. So I find out that I have a cyst on my vocal cords and I have to get surgery. And so my mom, thank God she was working this job where she had some insurance and I could be on the insurance because the medical system in America is crazy. And she was like, we'll do whatever we got to do to get your voice back. And so I did the surgery. And then when I woke up, my mom was crying. And I thought it was because, you know, something had gone wrong. And this was the same time that Julie Andrews had gotten this surgery. These surgeries were really new around this time. And Julie Andrews had got the surgery and she lost her voice forever. So I was thinking that's what my mom was going to say. And then she was like, well, the doctor went in to take the cyst out of your vocal cords and it was gone. And he had scoped you before he went in. And when he went in, it was gone. It said it actually like someone had already taken it out. And so he just removed the scar tissue. So it's kind of a miracle. And he was like, I've never seen anything like this before in my life. And then I was quiet for 3 months. I couldn't speak. I had to use the whiteboard. I had to put a whiteboard around my neck because this is like pre-iPad, pre-text, pre-all of that. I had a whiteboard around my neck and I would just write and not speak for 3 months. And then I got my voice back. I started working with an opera singer who basically rehabilitated my voice. And that's the voice I have today.
So where were Aladdin and Something Rotten? Were they pre this or post this?
Oh, this was post this. Yeah, this was after this. This was just when I was first starting to go to university. So I ended up not going to the music school. They were like, well, do you want to go into musical theater? Because you can wait a year to recover your voice and then go into musical theater. And that's how I kind of just happened upon it because of this surgery. So if that surgery hadn't happened, I would have been teaching music somewhere in North Carolina. But because it happened,
and we would have all missed the wonderful Marisha Wallace on the stage.
You would have never met me.
Now, I think it's fair to say, reading from what you sent me, is that you've had to climb some mountains along the way. Personal challenges that have undoubtedly shaped you into the resilient star that you are. And for the listeners, it's important, I think, for them to understand that behind every face there is a story. And whilst I know you had a difficult childhood, your second event that you sent to me was your divorce. And your scam. Now, listen, I'm very, very in tune with this. I've had 3 divorces, Marisha, and they all got worse one after the other. But I'm dying to hear about yours.
Mine was actually quite sad because we met when I was 22. We were both from like very rural towns. He was from Australia and I was from North Carolina. We started out working on cruise ships together. He was the drummer in the band. I was the singer. We were both like struggling artists together. Then I started becoming a little bit more successful and then got us to the point where we could move to New York. And I thought everything was going well, but everything is different when you're on a cruise ship and your whole life is paid for. You don't have to worry about food and bills and all that stuff. So then we got onto land. I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is a whole nother thing. And then he too had a lot of mental health issues that really reared their heads once we got to New York. Because New York is already a hard place to live anyway. So to be a musician and not be doing the thing you want to do, because you got to work side jobs, you got to like be a bartender, you have to like hustle, you have to make connections and then still pay your rent, you know, while you're trying to do all that. So it was tough on us. And then when I got the call to come to London, I was like, I'm going to give it a couple of more months and see if we can make it work. But I knew it was over because I knew that this is where God wanted me to be. I knew that this was the start of my new life. And if I didn't leave this person, I wasn't going to have the life that I needed to have because I was so consumed. I don't even remember that person. Like that person that I was in that relationship feels like a completely different person than who I am today.
Did you leave him in New York then or did he come with you?
He came with me for a little while, and then he went on a ship and he came back, and then I divorced him while I was here in my second year of Dreamgirls, which was very, very hard because I was going through a divorce while I was playing Effie White, breaking up with someone on stage and crying my eyes out every day. So it was really hard. And subsequently, because I, you know, was in that vulnerable place, going through a divorce, feeling alone, living in a new country, starring in a Western show, there's so much going on. I met this guy and he kind of like took advantage of me. And he scammed me out of £60,000 because he said he was an investor.
What do you mean?
So he taught me about investing and things like that. And I had like an account. It looked completely legit. Like I had a login. I had like what I was investing in was on the graphs and everything. I even got money back, like physical money back into my account. So like I was thinking, oh, it's working. But what he was doing was sending me my own money back to keep me to put more money in. It was like a full... It was an organized crime, if that makes sense. He wasn't the only one. There was a lot of people involved in the crime. But the crazy part was he was actually working at a real place. And so he learned what those people did in the actual real place and told me what it was, but sent my money somewhere else, but sent my money to his brother in Turkey. It was crazy. So when I unraveled the whole thing, I was devastated because I was like, I didn't really like him like that. Like, you know how somebody recommends something to you because of their friend? And you're like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Let me try that. Because I was looking for somewhere to put my money anyway. And I thought it was working. I mean, I was very naive because I trust people, like, especially someone who's been sitting in my house. Like, it wasn't like somebody who was online. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was someone I'd met that I had went to dinners with that I knew. But then... Yeah, all unraveled, and I reported them to the police. I found his workplace, and they questioned him and were like, did you do this? And he confessed, and then he wasn't arrested. He fled back to Cyprus, so he was never arrested or never charged, and I tried to get him charged. But at that time, it was about 2018, they didn't really know about digital fraud and digital scam like they do now. Like, it's a whole different world now. Like, if this had happened now, he would have been arrested.
Did you get your money back?
No, I didn't get my money back. No. And I'm glad that... So the lawyer from the firm helped me through it, which was very interesting because he was like, they're going to start calling you to say, if you give us 10,000 more pounds, we'll get your money out. He's like, but you can't, you just can't because they're never going to give it to you.
You've learned a few life lessons along the way, haven't you?
Yeah, I've learned a lot of lessons.
And are you in a good place now? We're going to talk about your career in a minute.
Yeah.
Are you in a good place now?
Yeah, I'm in a great place now. Like, this is the happiest I've ever been. My career is flourishing. Like, my personal life is flourishing. I feel like I know who I am. I just became a British citizen, which is really cool.
I saw that. And I think
I'm a dual citizen.
Weren't you congratulated by the king or something? Did I read that somewhere?
I was. Yeah, he was. Yeah, I sang the British national anthem at the Royal Variety this past year, and I got to meet the king, and he said, I hear you're getting your citizenship. I'm so proud of you. And it was really nice. And he knew my name. He knew all about it. It was crazy. And I had met him a couple of times last year doing some concerts for them. So it was really amazing because I came here. I was only supposed to be here 3 weeks, you know, from the first life-changing event, from the tap dancing egg to Effie White. And then almost 9 years later, here I am meeting the king and becoming a citizen. I'm so glad all those crazy things happened to me because it made me who I am today.
Absolutely shaped you. Now, the other thing that you shared is weight loss.
Yeah.
You lost 6 stone or something mad. And yet, when I linked onto this screen with you to do this podcast, you've got your face in a thing of Marks and Spencer's Millionaire Bites. So we all want to know how you can lose 6 stone eating the Millionaire Bites from Marks and Spencer's.
Well, that's like was the full unraveling. So I started in 2020. So it's been about 5 years now. But I've been on a diet since I was 10. We've been told everything. No carbs, eat carbs, no fat, low fat, protein, no meat, all meat. Like, women go through actual hell when it comes to diet, weight loss. We've been taught diet culture from a very, very early age. So I got fed up with, like, being on the yo-yo of gaining 30 pounds, losing 40 pounds, gaining 40 pounds. It was just going round and round. And then so at my biggest weight, I was about 260 pounds in the pandemic, because I went from, like, doing 8 shows a week, which kind of kept my weight down. I still wasn't, like, skinny, but, like, just kept my weight down. And then we went into the pandemic where we weren't working at all. We were just sitting around. So my weight just ballooned during that time. And also, it was post the scam. It was post the divorce. So I kind of ate my way through it. And I was just wanting to make a change. So I started doing, like, HIIT workouts in my living room. And I lost some weight from that. But I was like, there's got to be a better way than this, me dying on the floor like a cockroach every day. So I got with a fitness coach. So online fitness coaching had just kind of started at this time in the pandemic. And her name was Leanne Marshall. She was an ex-performer as well. She had been, like, Chicago and things. And she just basically rewired my whole brain about food, about calories in, calories out, macros. So, like, not just because we're used to counting calories, but it's like the quality of the calorie as well, like protein and fat. You need every food group. You need fats, carbs, proteins, and balance. So that also means you can have a millionaire bar every once in a while, like, as part of your life. I think because we get so strict either way, it's not sustainable. So I found something that was very sustainable. And then I started lifting heavy. So, like, I can hip thrust 130 kilo bar, and, like, I can chest press or, like, shoulder press 28 kilos, 32 kilos over my head. But that's when my body actually started to take shape. And then I just started losing weight. And that was when I tried less. So then I would only go to the gym 3 to 4 times a week instead of every day killing myself because I was doing the proper things. But this is how men train. And I think women have been taught, because we make the fitness industry a lot of money, to do things that don't work. Because if it worked, we wouldn't come back, right? If it worked, we wouldn't keep doing it. If the diet actually worked, then why do we have to keep coming back? So that's what it's designed for, us to keep coming back so that we make them money. But when you find something that is actually sustainable, then you don't have to keep coming back. It's just a way of life. It's a lifestyle change. And that's what I did. And then I lost 80 pounds and I've kept it off for about 5 years, which has been amazing. And your weight still fluctuates, but my basic shape stays the same. And, like, if I need to tighten up for something, I know how to do that. And if I need to be chill, I know how to do that. I just have a better relationship with my body in general.
Very, very determined. I'm very impressed. I always say I've spent a lifetime watching my weight, sort of eat but don't swallow. And I always said that when they lift the box, when I die, I just want them to say, my God, she was thin.
No!
Shakespeare famously said that all the world's a stage and all the men and women are merely players. They have their exits and they have their entrances. And I'm very into these quotes. I love all these. And I also love Joan Rivers, but she wasn't apt actually for our chat today. But you're 40 years old, I think.
I'll be 40 in September.
That's what I do. I have an event company that we do big 40ths.
All right.
What has life got in store for you? If you could play one role, what would your entrance be? Who would it be?
One role? In a play?
Play, stage, screen. What would you play? Who would you want to be? I suppose two questions. What character would you play? And who do you look up to? You know, who's your, not idol, because I hate that word, but we all have people in an industry that we admire and that we respect. And we think, you know, I'd like to be a little bit of them.
I think the role I would play would be one that's brand new. Like, I think there are a lot of stories that haven't been told yet. And I feel like original stories are really important. I think because of my type, what I look like, what I sound like, they don't make a lot of roles for us. So I think my best thing would be to do something very brand new and original. That's what I would love, to create a character that no one's ever seen before, but knows because they're relatable. So that's what I would love to do. And then I think looking up to people, I really love Viola Davis. I think she is the epitome of like resilience, because she's been in this business for so long and she's been counted out for being darker skinned and older and size wise and you whatever. Like, she should have the career of Meryl Streep, but she can't, you know? So, but she still perseveres, even with all of the resistance against her success. I think she's just such a great role model, and the fact that she gets it. She gets that what we're up against, and she's not like afraid to challenge it. And I think that's what I love about her.
Do you still think that the color of one's skin can present you with unfair challenges and restrictions in this day and age? Because you've referred to it a couple of times. In the industry that you're in, do you think that it restricts you?
Absolutely.
Do you think you're playing Sally Bowles because you are black? Or do you think you're playing Sally Bowles because you got the most fucking amazing voice?
I think it's both.
Do you?
Because, like, yes. Because I think, am I the most talented at it? Yes. Am I also black? Yes. Everything is both. And I think it opens it up for everyone else. And it opens it up to an audience to see yourself. If you don't see yourself represented, you don't think that you can do things. If you don't see someone who looks like you doing something, then you don't think it's for you. There's so many people who come to this show who are like, oh my God, I didn't even know there were black people in Nazi Germany at that time, which is completely historically inaccurate. But because they can see a black person in the time period on the stage, it opens their mind to a whole nother reality that, hey, maybe the Holocaust and Nazi Germany, what happened there, is all of our history, not one group's history, and that maybe we should do something to try to make sure that doesn't happen again as a collective, not just for one group. And I think that's what's been really important, because if we keep allowing the same group of people to shine in this space, you're not getting the diversity of story that you want. Like, I think what we have brought to this piece, just by changing the race, has changed all the stakes. It's changed how people see the show. It's just a picture with a different filter. It's the same picture. It's the same picture, but with a different filter on it, things look differently. Things feel differently. And that's the beauty of art, because you could go see it with a different cast and get something else out of it. And then you could see it with us and then get a whole different thing out of it. But it's important, because if we don't have diverse people leading shows, we don't even have access to wealth, awards, to other movies, to other, like, to move up in the industry. The glass ceiling is here if we don't have access to these leading roles. That's why it's important. And I think if we want to continue theater to live and not just have it be one demographic coming to see the show, which it will die with that demographic, then it has to be diverse. It has to change. It needs to reflect what the world actually looks like, because the world is not one color. The world is, when you step outside of your house, you see people of all different sizes, all different colors, all different shapes, from different cultures. But why doesn't our stages reflect that same thing? So that's always been like the issue for me, because in our world, people look different.
I could talk about this with you for hours and hours, because as a Jewish girl from a traditional Jewish background, I could engage in this conversation with you for hours and hours. And I think you're right. I think you are 100% right. But interestingly enough, when you said to me, and when I asked you what you were doing, you said, I'm playing Sally Bowles in Cabaret. And I immediately said, I'm coming to see you. It never crossed my mind that it was a Black artist playing a white character. What crossed my mind was, she must be good to have nabbed that role. That, seriously, that was my initial instinct.
No, that's
now,
good.
You know, it's a whole different thing, and that whole conversation could take us down a different route, but I get it. I get it.
It's important, and I think it's important, but I've had Jewish people who've come to see the show with us in it, and they were like, it made our story even mean more. It, like, the Jewish, because there's a Jewish couple.
You know, I think
there's a Jewish couple in it too, and it makes their story stronger.
I think that the minorities get the essence of it much more than the majorities. I do think that, and I think I consider the Jewish race as part of that. But we can't go down that, because otherwise we'll be here for 3 hours. But
yeah.
I want to ask you something. What secret ingredients, lady, do you think you have that has made you a star? Because you're quite sort of, you're quite humble about it. You're low-key.
Mm-hmm.
What secret ingredient have you got?
I think my secret ingredient is vulnerability, I think, because I'm not afraid to show parts of myself that some people keep secret, or parts of myself that people are afraid to share, being it my weight loss journey or my you know, bouts with love, my heartbreaks or all that. So people feel connected to you when they feel like that you're like them. Like, because we all feel pain and we all feel rejected and we all feel that things seem impossible, but then I also can inspire you by saying, okay, we may feel all those things, but we can also overcome. And I think that's what's been my resilience on top of that has been my biggest asset.
After Cabaret, have you got anything lined up?
I do, but I don't know if I can say.
Oh! Well, I will wait. First of all, I hope I shall be invited to the opening night. I shall definitely be seeing you at the Kit Kat Club. You are gorgeous. I'm going to go and buy those millionaire chocolate bars. And I'm going
They're
to...
They're very good.
So that when they lift my box, I'll be 80 pounds lighter. And thank you so, so much for joining me.
You're welcome, my love. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Events That Made Me. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure you listen to my conversation with actress Jodie Prenger on a previous series of Events That Made Me. I'll be back with another conversation soon. In the meantime, do not forget to review the podcast and follow so that you don't miss one episode.